Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. All this week, we've been talking with some of our listeners about the music your parents played for you before you started choosing your own. You know, this is important because kids are blank slates, musical sponges. And then, as we hit our teenage years, most of us reach another stage where we're, again, just soaking up music from other people, although usually not our parents.
I was sort of also just at an important age of, like, where, you know, you become this musical sponge for, you know, your older record collector buddies are like, hey, check this out, incredible string band. Oh, you like that? Okay, check this out. That was before any sort of internet presence, and we didn't have a cool record store in Nashville at the time.
That's guitarist William Tyler. He eventually worked in a record store and found himself discovering all sorts of music he'd never heard before, including the late American guitarist John Fahey, whose so-called American primitive style became a big influence. William Tyler will play for us in just a little while, and we'll hear more of your recollections of the music your parents first played for you. But first, as long as we're talking about record stores, I should probably remind you that Record Store Day is coming up fast. See, every third Saturday in April since 2008, the faithful have lined up at the doors of their local independent record stores to buy up limited edition vinyl in honor of Record Store Day, a day that celebrates, yes, records and the people who love them. But not everyone embraces the notion. In fact, there are some who think that one day for records is pandering and silly. We will take a look at both sides of the issue in today's
Soundcheck Smackdown.
Joining me in the studio, once again, Billboard editor Joe Levy. Joe, good to have you back.
Good to be here.
And Ben Greenman, editor and writer at The New Yorker. Welcome, Ben.
Hey, Joe.
Let's start, before I give you guys a chance to stake out your positions, with a statement from this year's Record Store Day ambassador to introduce the whole thing.
Hey there. My name's Jack White. I've been duly elected by a two-thirds majority of citizens of the world as your Record Store Day ambassador for 2013. Of course, I'm no stranger to the title ambassador, as I grew up near the Ambassador Bridge in Detroit, Michigan when I was young. Today, I thought I'd take you to a secret place, United Record Pressing Plant here in Nashville, and give you an insider's view of how records are really made from the get-go. And maybe you'll learn a few other things about the music industry as well.
Yes, singer, guitarist, songwriter, producer Jack White is this year's Record Store Day ambassador. Joe Levy, why do we care about Record Store Day?
Because we love records. I mean, if we don't, I'm not sure we do care about Record Store Day. But if we like music, if we like records, if we like record stores, if we like the culture around record stores, that sense of recommendation and argument, the humanity involved in actually seeing people buy music as opposed to the easy, frictionless consumption of music over the internet, I'm not opposed to that either, then why should we not like Record Store Day, a day to honor record stores? You know what? I love my mom all year round, but I don't say no to Mother's Day.
Ben, I suspect that Joe just, stole a little bit of your argument there.
I'm not going to speak about anybody's mom. That seems untoward. But my argument against it is I think maybe there's overlap. Like when people attack Obama from the left and say that he's not liberal enough. Because my problem with it is that I don't think it is Record Store Day. I think that's a lie. I think it's a misnomer in that it's, in fact, Record Fetish Day. And when you look at the products that are put out for it and you look at the way that it's promoted, when I was a kid growing up, records were already being phased out. LPs, vinyl was already being phased out. And we were into, there were some records, but more people bought cassettes and more people bought CDs, or that process had already started. That was the brick and mortar staple. We get to Record Store Day now, and there's a very self-conscious sort of almost toy collector-like step back to this era of specialty records and a newly minted set of collectibles that seems to me to be both beside the point and also a distraction from tending to the general health of the record industry and record retail, or music retail, let's say.
So, Joe, do you think that, you know, we do get distracted by the shiny new special 7 inches that are, you know, the singles that are released for Record Store
Day? I love shiny new stuff. You know, it's absolutely true. They studied years ago, they studied the effect of shiny objects on primates. And if you show them shiny new objects, they get excited. And vinyl is a shiny new object. I'm not joking with you, but here's the thing. Obviously, Record Store Day solves all of our problems. We made this day. There are brand new records, and our problems are solved. And here's the weird thing. Ben's not wrong. It's fetishistic. But vinyl, not dying. Mm-hmm. Vinyl, growing. Growth of vinyl since Record Store Day began. We're selling about 5 times as much vinyl a year now. This is brand new vinyl, so we're not even counting used records, which is where most of my vinyl purchases are. But in 2007, we were selling a little under 100,000 pieces of brand new vinyl a year. Now, 4.6 million. Mm. That's healthy. Did Record Store Day cause that? No. Is it a megaphone in order to broadcast that message? Is vinyl something that people are manifestly interested in, young and old? Yeah.
Well, there are a lot of these special Record Store Day vinyl releases, and Sharon Van Etten collaborated with the band Shearwater on one of them. It's a cover of the Stevie Nicks song Stop Dragging My Heart Around, which they did for the AV Club and is now being released as a limited 7-inch single of 3,000 copies. Stop dragging Sharon Van Etten and the band Shearwater collaborating on a version of the Stevie Nicks song Stop Dragging My Heart Around, which the Sub Pop label is releasing as a limited edition, a run of 3,000 copies of this 7-inch single for Record Store Day, which is the third Saturday of April every year since 2008, and it is obviously this Saturday. Ben, were you opposed to the idea of Record Store Day from day one?
No. I was not opposed to it from day one. I think my opposition started around day three. And I think that as a way of bringing attention to the back to the floundering and then now in some ways rebounding record retail industry, it definitely has some merit. But the song that you just played in a way demonstrates my problem with it, which is that a lot of what we get on Record Store Day are one-offs or odd collaborations, and there's nothing wrong with that. I love the idea of artists collaborating with other artists that they wouldn't normally work with or that they're their friends or stretching themselves. But I do think that that raises another question, which is where is the likelihood that someone, a consumer, is going to go into a store and buy not even necessarily vinyl, but in any physical version, just a normal old John Prine record or a normal old Eminem record rather than some odd Eminem John Prine collaboration, which is on a special color vinyl, you know, 7-inch. And I don't know the answer to that. I know there's overall a rebound.
Wait, do you know the answer? Is there an Eminem John Prine collaboration?
It's great. It's fantastic. It's really good. But it's
it keeps playing in Ben's head over and over again. And nowhere else.
So the question for me is sort of that. Now, I'm not against, I mean, I think the numbers are clear that it's helping vinyl rebound. And the numbers are clear in some ways, I think, and maybe Joe could speak to this, that things are not as dire as we think overall for record retail, that this year there was a little rebound. But I don't know that it's all been untangled why this is happening. And I do think that I agree more with the point that Joe made initially, which is that it's not so much for me record store day. That's a little bit of a misnomer. We should either, first of all, it's record day, really, not record store day. Mm-hmm. But what I really would like to see, and this is what Joe mentioned at the beginning, is record store process immersion day, week, year. It's not so much going to the store. It's what you mentioned, that you go and you, on the way to get one CD, you see another one. On the way to buy it at the counter, someone else has discarded one, and you see that, and that touches something. All the things that don't happen, as you said, in the frictionless world of online purchasing, that's the experience that I think needs to be tended to and sort of maintained and conserved.
Soundcheck listeners, what do you think of Record Store Day? You can leave us a comment on our website, soundcheck.org, or leave us a voicemail at 866-939-1612. Ben Greenman is a writer and editor at The New Yorker, not so sanguine about what Record Store Day has become these days. Joe Levy, editor at Billboard, still enthusiastic about the third Saturday of April. Joe, who is this for? I mean, Ben was just saying, are we celebrating records? Are we celebrating record stores? I have an even more specific question, which is Record Store Day seems to be the indie rock world sort of gazing at its collective navel. You don't see a whole lot of hip-hop or the major labels really getting on board.
Well, the major labels are involved. The major labels enjoy their vinyl, particularly mm-hmm. Sony Legacy, which goes nuts on Record Store Day. And if you need a limited edition copy of Miles Davis's Milestone reissued in mono, I can help you with that.
But only on Record Store Day?
No, it's available on other days as well. But this is a promotion for them. It's a chance for them to highlight collectible, as Ben said, fetishized work. Mm-hmm. And in fact, mm-hmm. a lot of the reissue world highlights fetishized work. But that said, major labels are involved. Does it touch the indie rock world and the rock world in general more than the hip-hop world? Yes. Are there special hip-hop albums that are reissued on vinyl at Record Store Day? Yeah, there's a limited edition of Ready to Die, the Biggie Smalls record, that I believe is on rainbow colored or white vinyl for this Record Store Day. So you can't say it doesn't happen. It is a fetish object from years ago that people grew up with. And you're asking, who's it for? I'm going to go with nerds. Those are the same people I grew up collecting records with. We're a special kind of people. But there apparently are more of us than you think. Look, you know, who used to get 7-inches from the Sub Pop 7-inch club back in the 90s? Those are your people for Record Store Day. The thing is there's a general culture here. Mm-hmm. This is part of a vinyl culture that's caught on in a way we didn't think it could. If you had told me 6 years ago, oh, by the way, vinyl sells under 100,000 right now, but in a few years, you're going to be selling close to 5 million of it. I would have said, you are a dreamer, sir. Mm. I would like to live in your world, but I don't.
Ben?
I just wanted to say one thing about the indie rock world. I think there's a big classic rock, or what, I don't know if that's even a valid term these days, but I'll just use it and then everyone can complain later. For example, there's a Big Star documentary coming out, and the soundtrack, it's called Nothing Can Hurt Me, the movie. And the soundtrack to the movie is coming out on Record Store Day this year. One of the strange things is when you open it up, you use your razor or your fingernail to open up the cellophane. Mm-hmm. Out of that will slide an MP3 download coupon. So that if you get the fetish object and you don't really want to listen to it because you either want to keep it in the closet or you want to preserve it, or like most people, you don't have a turntable set up out and working, you can just get the music via the current mm-hmm. digital route. And so I think that's another question too. This is what I was saying earlier about in my youth, records, they hadn't vanished by any means, but they had already given way to cassettes and CDs because the hardware had changed. So it seems a little odd to have Record Store Day without turntable renaissance. I think a lot of these are just ending up, as Joe said, as sort of nerd collectibles.
Yeah, objets d'art, art objects of a sort.
And they're valid as that. I mean, I think the reason someone once said that there will always be more nerds. The nerds will always grow in number because they reproduce via asexual reproduction. so you can't stop them. But they.
Well, that would have been a relief to me in high school, but it didn't work. It didn't work.
Oh,
we checked in Billboard, and you sell about 100,000 to 115,000 turntables a year. And it's not a lot, but people are buying turntables, and I think they play these records. The fact that you get an MP3 card to download music as well enables you to enjoy it in all the other formats. So you get it on your phone as well as your turntable.
Right.
Why should you be limited to just
to have your cake and to eat it too? Now, the band Grizzly Bear is a good exemplar of what happens on Record Store Day. Grizzly Bear sees 20% of their sales coming from albums, and their 2012 record Shields, including this song Sleeping Ute, is no exception. Just wandering free. Though I'm far gone, you sleep nearer to me. If I could find peace, if this night. Van Grizzly Bear, they do a lot of business in vinyl. This is, you know, we're not talking about Eminem or Madonna, but for an indie rock band of some note, vinyl, and by extension, perhaps Record Store Day, pretty important to them. Record Store Day is this Saturday, April 20th. You can find a link to the full list of Record Store Day offerings on our website, soundcheck.org. Ben Greenman of The New Yorker, Joe Levy of Billboard on opposite sides. Gentlemen, closing statements. Ben?
I would say that I'm not against it in principle so much as the kind of ghost that hovers over everybody as they enter the store, making scary ghost noises. And I'm warning people not to let it go in a way in the direction that it started off in, which is to become more like Yadro Day or Vintage Baseball Cap Day, where these become only objects and the broader process is forgotten and left by the wayside as we stockpile fancy-looking colored vinyl.
All right, Joe?
I like my fancy-looking colored vinyl, but I'll say this. Anything that makes people excited about consuming music, paying for music, a rarity in this world, and not a bad thing. To me, anything that makes people excited about music, I'm not turning my nose up. And I really don't care what it is. I don't care if it's Rush going into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame or this. If it gets you psyched, I'm happy for you.
Well, whether you like Record Store Day or not, you can't stop it from coming. It's the day after tomorrow, Saturday, April 20th. Check out all the goodies online at soundcheck.org. Ben, Joe, guys, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Soundcheck. That's a track called Kanono Ripoff Number 1 from Dan Deacon, ripping off the Congolese band Kanono Number 1. It's a funny title from the Baltimore-based electronic musician. He is releasing this song as a special 7-inch single for Record Store Day. This week we've been hearing from some of you about the music that your parents played for you when you were a kid. Susan called us up this week to tell us about her mom, who actually played in a band and had a long list of artists to play for young Susan when she was growing up in the 60s and 70s.
I mean, it was Engelbert Humperdinck and Tom Jones, Nat King Cole, Bobby Darin, the Mills Brothers.
glow, a little glow and fly a fire. Glow like an incandescent wire. Glow for the female of the species. Turn on the AC and the DC. This night could use a little brightening. Light up, you little old bug of lightning. When you gotta glow, you gotta glow. Glow, little glow and glow.
Jim Reeves, Johnny Mathis. It was pretty fascinating because I had a very rich music in my life as a child. While I didn't play music myself or sing, it was always part of my life.
How the shadows deep and darken, you and your chicks should get to sparking. I got a gal that I love so. Glow, little glowworm, glow. Glow, little glowworm, turn the key on. You are equipped with taillight neon. You got a cute vest pocket master, which you can make both slow and faster. I don't know who you took.
That's the song Glowworm from the Mills Brothers, one of the artists that our listener Susan grew up listening to, thanks to her musical mom. And thanks to Susan for calling in. You can tell us about the music your parents played for you. Leave us a message at 866-939-1612. Speaking of parents, the guitarist William Tyler, who grew up in Nashville, had a dad who wrote songs for Eddie Rabbit and Kenny Rogers and other country stars. But as a teenager, William was hooked by the guitar work of John Fahey. We'll hear William Tyler playing songs from his new album, Impossible Truth, next. I'm John Schaefer, and we are joined in the Soundcheck studio today by William Tyler, a well-traveled guitarist who's worked with indie artists like Lamb Chop and the late country music veteran Charlie Louvin. In the background, you're hearing William Tyler's second album as a solo guitarist. It's called Impossible Truth. And here at Soundcheck, we like this mesmerizing collection of songs so much that we were falling all over each other to book him for the studio today. This first song that he's going to play for us is called Portrait of Sarah. Here's William Tyler, live on Soundcheck.
Thank you.
That is guitarist William Tyler with his piece called Portrait of Sarah, played live here in the Soundcheck studio, although you'll find it on his latest record, Impossible Truth, as well. William Tyler, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks for having me.
So, Portrait of Sarah. She sounds like a graceful lady, but one full of surprises.
That actually is a pretty good description of her.
Really? Who is Sarah?
She's my girlfriend.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, she's, I wrote that right, I guess right when we met. It was about 2 years ago. Yeah, it was sort of a courtship song.
Uh-huh.
And it definitely, like...
And how did that go over?
she was very flattered.
Okay, good.
But, I mean, I think just the nature of that song, it's obviously very hopeful in its melodic structure, I think, and it's a lot more, probably joyful than some of the other stuff on this record, and I think that was why I wanted it in there sort of as a intermission piece almost, of, you know.
A little streak of light.
Yeah, a streak of light and a lot of, you know, in a room of moodiness. So.
Well, I mean, the album Impossible Truth, it has titles like Country of Illusion, The Geography of Nowhere, We Can't Go Home Again. I mean, there does seem to be a kind of, I don't know, a recurring, I don't know if you'd call it a theme, but a recurring mood of kind of dislocation, perhaps.
It's a theme of dislocation, I think a theme of, I mean,
World-weariness? You just sound so world-weary there, William.
I sounded world-weary. World-weary is what happens when you get a guy from Nashville in New York for more than 24 hours. No, I'm just kidding. There is a concept behind the record. I mean, there's definitely a heavy apocalypse vibe in it, and I think, you know, that's very intentional. And the titles are explicit references to certain things and, you know, books, moods, but I want to get people engaged in some sort of discussion or at least musing over some of the things that are thematically at play here. And, most of them are pretty morose, but the music's also, you know, it's instrumental music. And
right.
So by its nature, I feel like it's opening itself up for either kind of a little more deliberate listening or complete ignoring, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's either completely ambient or completely... engaging.
Your first record was also instrumental.
Right.
Have you written songs? I mean, actual, you know, lyrics?
Lyrics. Yeah, it's actually something I used to do quite a bit, but it almost feels like a different lifetime. And yeah. I mean, I'm not trying to, like, make it sound like it's more important than it is. It's just I started writing songs when I was 17, 18, you know, in bands in high school. And they tended to be kind of a little more sophisticated power pop type songs. I was listening to a lot of Elvis Costello and Nick Lowe and stuff like that. And I guess I was, it's just one of those things where I think the further away I got from being in a band where I was the singer and the writer, which basically was the entirety of my 20s. And that was spent like being a side person with other people. And I think I just kind of stopped doing my own music because I was at a age where, you know, you tend to be re-examining a lot of things, especially if you're backing up other people and they're older than you and they're more experienced. And, you know, there's a combination of second guessing. There's a combination of just reevaluating and learning about new musical forms. And just the process of that, I completely stepped away from writing anything. And when I came back to it, it was in this sort of fragmentary approach of like, writing pieces but not necessarily finishing them and then being like, well, I don't have any words, so I'm just going to leave it
as an
instrumental. And, you know, that's how that process started.
Now, you worked with all these different people, Silver Jews and Lamb Chop, the late Charlie Louvin, and so many others, but you also mentioned listening to, you know, Elvis Costello and that whole crowd. At what point did you discover John Fahey, the late American guitarist?
Pretty early. I mean, I had a – I don't know if it's still in print, but there was – when I was 16, I went to the bookstore and found the Spin Alternative Record Guide. And I remember, like, they had entries for all these different people, like, you know, that I'd never heard of. Can, John Zorn, Fahey, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And that was the only source I had, literally. I mean, I had,
really?
Like, books, you know, Trouser Press Guide and whatever, old record collector guides. Because, you know, that was that was before any sort of internet presence, and we didn't have a cool record store in Nashville at the time. So I went to the library and, you know, checked out a John Fahey CD, and, you know, it was one of those things that was just part of a musical self-education at that time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think around the time that I started playing in Lamb Chop, I was 19, 20, around that age, and I was sort of also just at an important age of, like, where, you know, you become this musical sponge for, you know, your older record collector buddies are like, hey, check this out, incredible string band. Oh, you like that? Okay, check this out. And then I worked at a record store for a while, and a lot of that stuff would come through, and Sandy Bull was another huge influence. You know, it just that just kind of absorbing that, and then I don't really even remember when I started trying to mess around with the fingerstyle method of guitar.
Here's the thing, though, because, you know, people referred to what Fahey did with the open tunings and
right.
the finger picking and the mix of different – they referred to it as American primitive.
Right.
And there, as you well know, playing, you know, some of this stuff you saw, there's nothing primitive about it. It's quite a sophisticated approach to the guitar.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting term. I don't feel, like, educated enough about the origin of that term to comment on it, other than, yeah, it's certainly what he did is not primitive. You know, I just think that he came along at such an important point in, you know, American music, where there really was this attempt of, like, people like my age or whatever, like, rediscovering the pre-war blues stuff, mm-hmm. and that becoming something that was, like, they were collector's items now and not just, like, old records.
Right.
And then you had people who were truly visionary like him reappropriating that music and doing something completely original with it, and you know that's why he is who he is, and he looms incredibly large over anything that anybody does with solo guitar.
Yeah. Well, we're speaking with William Tyler for our WDET listeners. He's performing on April 22nd at PJ's Logger House in Detroit, and playing for us, obviously, here in the studio. Now, you've picked up an electric guitar, right?
This is an electric 12-string. Yep.
You don't see so many of those. What are you going to play on this?
I'm going to do a song. This is also an Impossible Truth. It's called Cadillac Desert.
All right. Once again, William Tyler with us live on Soundcheck. Cadillac Desert is the song from William Tyler, the guitarist with us on Soundcheck today. There's a version of that on his latest record, Impossible Truth, that also features a bit of lap steel and even some vibraphones on the other version of that song. Nice to hear it in this solo version, though, on the electric 12-string guitar. So, William, you mentioned before that you actually worked in a record store at one point in Nashville, right?
Yeah. So I think that's a rite of passage for a struggling musician. Be surrounded by things that you can't afford but you want to listen to.
All right. So you would be a good person to toss this question to. We were debating earlier in the program Record Store Day, you know, which is this Saturday, because it was this idea that seemed like a good idea 5 years ago, and now there are some people who are saying, well, yeah, but it was a good idea 5 years ago. Now it's just like people doing these, you know, kind of weird little one-off things, and it's not really helping.
Right.
What do you think about Record Store Day?
Well, I mean, I do think it's, sadly, you know, maybe the one day of the year that there's attention brought to something that I think is the most important thing that's keeping music alive, other than things like public radio, because
would be record stores?
Independent record stores, sorry, yeah. Because, I mean, to be honest, I mean, I don't know what it's like here, but, I mean, in Nashville, there's one or two independent record stores, and the chains have all gone out of business.
Right.
And, you know, the small record stores are keeping everything alive, and they're really in the trenches. I mean, they're the kind of things where, you know, if you have a good relationship with a record store in a town, they can assure you that you have an audience for your music.
Yeah.
And that's happened to me. It's happened to a lot of my friends. I played a record store in Greenville, South Carolina. I've never even played a show in South Carolina. And, you know, the guy has a store there called Horizon. And there's the store in Nashville, Grimey's, that I'm friends with, they're, you know, similar, you know, independent model. And I think that the part maybe that gets a little exhausting is just how much the releases kind of are saturated on that day. And I just know from a fact, and having put out other people's records, because I used to have a small label, you know, the record plants, and everybody gets a little bit overexerted around there just trying to meet these crazy deadlines. But, you know, it's like Black Friday with other retail. I mean, it's like, you know, there has to be a period where everybody's, you know, racing to get something done. And just with the industry like independent music, I think it's just, I don't know. Yeah, I have mixed feelings about maybe like the Christmasification of it. But if it's like the one day of the year that people like remember to go down and, you know,
Hey, there's an independent record store
in
our
town.
Right,
I mean, because there's just so many things in today that we take for granted, and I just feel like that is like one of the last lifelines that we have that, you know.
Well, that seems like a very measured and nuanced response to our earlier Soundcheck Smackdown question from William Tyler. William is playing April 22nd at PJ's Logger House in Detroit. WDET listeners, you can catch him there. The new album from William Tyler is called Impossible Truth. And William, thank you so much for performing for us here in the studio today.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Soundcheck. If you liked our session with William Tyler, there's more on our website, including more music and conversation and a video we shot here in the studio. Check it out at soundcheck.org. By the way, join us online tomorrow afternoon at 2 for an in-studio performance by Carl Hancock Rux. He's a poet, spoken word artist, and singer as well. He'll join us 2 p.m. tomorrow at soundcheck.org. Up next, Joe Keyes of eMusic joins us to share some of his favorite new releases. This is Soundcheck. Time to hear about some new releases. We've asked eMusic's editor-in-chief, J. Edward Keyes, to tell us about some of the music that's been catching his ear this spring. Joe, welcome back.
Thanks. It's good to be back.
Your list starts with The Knife.
Yeah.
A band that was the subject of a big review in the recent New Yorker, and which, you know, a band that's been around for a while.
Yeah. I really love this band, and am especially taken aback by this new record. They started out as, I guess you could say, sort of a conventional electronic band, a little bit on the darker side. You could hear some influences of Kate Bush. What they did on this record was really take it up a notch. This is less a pop record and more a fully conceived artistic work. There's a 19-minute song in the middle that they recorded in a boiler room, and it's basically just a 19-minute drone piece in the middle of this record, and it really is pushing the boundaries of what's acceptable in pop music and mm-hmm. demands full attention.
The album's called Shaking the Habitual. Is that an accurate title for what they've tried to do here?
Absolutely, and it's funny because that title works on two levels. It not only describes the way they're pushing the boundaries of electronic music, but once you get past the way the record sounds and get into the lyrics, it's really politically minded, and so they're shaking the political habitual as well, and the status quo, so it gets into queer theory and gender politics and the patriarchy and all those sorts of things. And so once you get your brain around how it sounds, there's even more to dig into with the lyrics.
They being the brother and sister team who are The Knife.
Karen and Olaf Dreyer Anderson, and they live, and when they all their public appearances, they go to great lengths to hide their face or disguise them or distort them. They had bird masks with these sort of threatening beaks at one point, and then there was a mask where someone's face was melting, and you really can't draw a solid bead on what these two look like, and that's kind of part of the act with The Knife.
Uh-huh. This is from the new album called Shaking the Habitual. This is not the 19-minute long ambient excursion, but a song called Without You, My Life Would Be Boring. From The Knife, from their new record called Shaking the Habitual, which is one that has caught the attention of J. Edward Keyes, the editor-in-chief of eMusic, sharing some new releases with us on Soundcheck. Joe, The Knife had a big hit maybe 10 years ago or more now, so they've been on the landscape for a while. Many people know who they are. Not so with your next pick, which is Jaco Gardner.
I believe, and I only found this after I saw him live, that it might be Jaco Gardner.
Okay. Where is he from?
He is from Amsterdam, which once you hear the music might not be surprising. He is a 24-year-old kid. He plays everything on the record. He lives and works in a studio that he calls Shadow Shop, which we interviewed him, and he admitted that he thinks it's actually illegal. Like, that it's not zoned to be anything in this studio where he lives.
Okay.
And the record is just this fantastic kaleidoscopic throwback to 60s psychedelia. You can hear a little bit of the Zombies and a little bit of Love and this great string sections and mellotrones and his kind of dreamy voice going over top all the songs.
And he does all those layers himself.
He does everything himself.
All right. A gifted young Dutchman named Jaco Gardner in a song called Clear the Air.
This feeling's just the same. Thank you.
Joe Keys, I can imagine a video for this with, like, the camera angle going through the kaleidoscope and the camera zooming in and out and everything. Very psychedelic 60s sound. Yako Gardner?
Yako Gardner. It's on a great label called Trouble in Mind.
And the album is called Cabinet of Curiosities. What else you got for us? Something a bit closer to home?
Yeah, absolutely. So this, you know, a lot of people talk about South by Southwest, for example, as a place where you don't really hear new music anymore. It's so overcrowded. Well, I want to couch this specifically as being a South by Southwest discovery for me. This is a woman named Laura Stevenson, who's from Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
And I had sort of heard her name for a little while, but had tuned out a bit because in my brain I thought it was this sort of kind of folk thing, singer-songwritery, not really my thing. Well, I happened to wander into her showcase at South by Southwest, and as it turned out, I couldn't have been more wrong. It was this big, tremendous, clanging sound. The band reminded me of Crazy Horse. She was in the middle holding it together with her really powerful voice. I immediately went back to my office when I got back to New York, dug out the promo of her new record, Wheel, and listened to it and was just thrilled with what I heard. It's become one of my favorite records of the year.
It comes out actually next Tuesday, and we premiered a track from her album this week on our website. You can visit soundcheck.org to stream this song called The Move.
These two back teeth the ground meet. I barely slept this week, but you're lovely in the morning, all reminding me why I should be sorry. Say, I love your brain, but I hate it when it pushes me away. Well, it's been down, and now you're finally finding out that I'm not supposed to get better. But I said I won't be quite like this forever, 'cause I'm a liar and a thief.
Laura Stevenson and a song called The Move. You can hear the whole thing on our website, soundcheck.org. We've been premiering this track from her forthcoming album, Wheel, which comes out next Tuesday and is already catching the ear of J. Edward Keys, editor-in-chief of E! Music, sharing some of his favorite new releases with us. And we have time for one more. What should it be?
Sure. So this is a band that, you know, I get... With the rise in the internet, you can find out everything about a band so quickly. Well, this is a band that has done a good job of there's no information about them at all. They're from Cambridge.
Now, is that a good job?
I love it. I think it's great. They're a band called – they used to be called Uncle Acid and the Deadbeats. Now they're just called Uncle Acid. Their whole aesthetic is 60s horror movies, 60s and 70s horror movies. They kind of sound like Queens of the Stone Age covering the Beatles. Really stomping doom metal, but great harmonies, really spooky lyrics. They've done a good job of preserving their anonymity. Their new record is called Mind Control, and the loose idea is that it's based around a Manson family-type cult.
Nice.
Yeah.
All
uplifting.
Right. Family fun for all listeners of all ages from the English band Uncle Acid. Joe, good to see you again. Thanks for dropping by.
Thanks. Good to be here.
We're going to end the show tonight with another voicemail about the music that your parents chose for you when you were too young to choose your own. This listener didn't leave her name, but she did leave her age.
I love listening to this show, but I'm 85 years old, and the music I listened to was Bing Crosby, Martin Block's The Make Believe Ballroom, Ted Husing on Saturday Morning, Jazz, and the NBC Symphony Orchestra with Arturo Toscanini.
Thank you.
was always music in my house, but we listened to all kinds of music. We had open minds about music, just as I was brought up to have open minds about people. Love your show.
Bit of the overture to Rossini's Il Signor Bruschino, something that was part of the childhood of our 85-year-old anonymous listener. Tell us what your parents had you listening to when you were a kid. Leave us a voicemail at 866-939-1612. Tomorrow on Soundcheck, we have a live in-studio performance by the British R&B singer and songwriter Jamie Liddell. Now, you heard William Tyler before talking about how he grew up in Nashville. Jamie Liddell now lives in Nashville. The two are neighbors. Also a pick three from our regular guest, the hip-hop journalist Soumya Krishnamurthy, and The Strange World of David Lee Roth. We'll talk with a music journalist who spent a Saturday night with a bona fide rock star and lived to tell the tale. That does it for tonight's show, but the show continues over at soundcheck.org with videos, podcasts, album streams, and much more. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.